From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on November 4th, 2014, Election Day, the midterms. Our focus is New York's 24th Congressional District, which stretches from Syracuse to Wayne County. Republican John Katko was challenging incumbent Democrat Dan Maffei. Katko was an assistant United States attorney who served as chief of the Organized Crime Division at the U.S. Attorney's Office in Syracuse. Katko would not only win his race against Dan Maffei in 2014, he won by 20 points, the largest margin of defeat for an incumbent in the country that year. And Katko easily won re-election last year. Now we get a chance to sit down with him to discuss a wide range of policy and issues: healthcare, terrorism, poverty, jobs, and more. One note for listeners: due to the congressman's schedule, we had to pre-record this conversation, so we can't take your calls and emails live with him today. And Congressman Katko, welcome to the program. And if I'm not mistaken, this is your first visit to our studio, is that right?
It is, that's right.
Well, thank you for being here.
Well, I'm happy to be here. I love coming and talking on radio, talking about different things, and love supporting public radio as well.
Well, and you know, you look at congressional districts, I think they're a little less weird than they used to be. I did a piece back in 2003 or four. I remember looking at Louis Slaughter's district that I said looked like sort of a diseased banana between Buffalo and Rochester. But you have to cover a lot of ground, I know, don't you?
Oh, there's no question. I cover for all of Wayne County, all of Cayuga County, all of Onondaga County, including the city of Syracuse, and then the western portion of Oswego, which includes the cities of Oswego and Fulton. So, yeah, I got a lot to cover. But you know what? I got a buddy of mine in Congress who has the entire state of Montana. And Montana stretches from Washington, D.C., basically to Chicago, Illinois. Try to cover that.
Wow.
At a couple hours, it's not so bad.
You know, you mentioned, public broadcasting, and I will say off the jump here, I saw an interview you did back in February with Robert Harding. I've seen, some of your remarks that you made. There is a stereotype out there that, the Republicans in Congress are going to cut the National Endowment of the Arts and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I know you've been vocal in your support. What you've said is at times you understand the complaints about some of the content, but you also don't feel like cutting is necessarily the right thing to do.
No, I don't think so either. Listen, we are under serious budget constraints on the federal level. And instead of taking a hatchet to the problem, you take a scalpel and try and find where you can find savings on everything. And, should we look at the budget for public broadcasting like we do every other budget? Of course. But that doesn't mean you just get rid of it because you don't like what people are saying, because that's not what America's about. But the bottom line is there's a lot of good programming, a lot of good content that is not controversial on public broadcasting, and the news that's on there, the programs about the historical perspectives, historical initiatives. We talked about Safe Haven. We mentioned before we got on the air, things like that. It serves a great purpose and a righteous purpose, and so I think it's an essential part of our fabric. It really is.
I just want to say we appreciate that. And
sure.
Now you've got half an hour of softballs coming from me as well.
Right on.
Let's go, man. You would be bored. You would be bored, I think. So, but I do want to ask you who the hardest hockey hitter in Congress is. You play hockey.
I play hockey.
Who is the hardest hitter in Congress?
I don't know. I'd like to think it was me, but I'm not sure. There's not many congressmen. There's only about a half dozen of us that play, and then we've got a bunch of staffers that play with us, and we play against the lobbyists or other groups. And the game against the lobbyists this year got pretty
I was going to ask you, do you hit harder when you're playing lobbyists?
Yes. my very first shift on the ice, this guy I know is a lobbyist, was on the other side, and your adrenaline's flowing. In my very first shift, I'm flying down the ice. Puck goes in the corner, and all of a sudden, he goes flying into the boards, and he took a really nasty spill. Turns out he had three fractured ribs, and one of them was a double fracture. And about a week later, he's in a hearing, and he's in the audience, of course, and I'm up on the committee, transportation committee, and I saw him, so he's like leaning sideways in gray. So I texted him and said, "You're a wuss if you don't sneeze right now." And he started to laugh, and he had to get up and leave because he was hurting so bad from the pain in his ribs. So yeah, it's a rough sport.
How often do you play?
Once a week, sometimes less, sometimes more. It all depends. But getting ready for the game, we played several times a week.
And yeah. you have some family history. Did I read your father or grandfather started a hockey, was it a league or something in the Syracuse?
Oh, yeah, my dad was one of the, helped found my high school hockey team. When we were boys then, and then he helped found the team. Then my brother and I both played on for 4 years, and It was a lot of fun, to say the least.
Are you too far away from Buffalo to grow up rooting for the Sabres? Who you grew up?
Oh, I love the Sabres. Yeah, the Sabres and the Rangers I really like. But the Sabres, my gosh, they never seem to get out of the starting gate. I don't know. They're not in the playoffs again.
Well, they think with Jack Eichel, eventually they're on the right track.
Yeah, but it seems like the league is littered with ex-Sabres. And that sometimes yes, worries me. It's like a lot of their talent goes elsewhere. And I would love to see them, you know, build a core and grow with it. And hopefully Eichel's going to be the real deal. He seems to be it. He's great.
Are some of the people I work with when we're down in Washington, you know, just monitoring the situation on possible budget cuts. And they had a meeting in your office and they said, boy, he loves music. You know, they saw Bruce Springsteen's autobiography sitting there. Mm-hmm. But Bruce Springsteen's pretty politically liberal. What did you make of his autobiography?
But his music's really good, man.
His music is
The last time I saw Springsteen was here in Rochester. There's a Blue Cross arena.
Yeah, Blue Cross, yeah.
That was about 2 years ago. He was fantastic. He was doing the River Tour.
And let me guess, it was probably like a 2.5-3 hour show. He says
more than that,
He still does these. I mean, at his age, it's incredible.
He's 67, and he just rocks it. And it was an unbelievable show. So, yeah, I can separate out his politics because his music's really good. And I spent a lot of my college days down at the Jersey Shore with my buddies from New York City when we often went to Niagara together. And so all the places, all the haunts he was at, like the Stone Pony and all that, we've been to all those. It's really kind of fun.
And I actually think, you know, you go back and especially listen to his music, you know, from albums like The River, all throughout the I think, the 70s into the 80s. He was a real voice of sort of a working class, the proletariat, the people who are really struggling in a way that should transcend politics in some ways.
And indeed he does. I mean, you know, he really does transcend politics, I think. I mean, he's as he got older, he got a little more vocal. But the bottom line is that you're exactly right. He's a blue-collar guy, and he acts like it. He never went to high school, never went to college. He barely got out of high school. And I think he went to one semester of community college, and then he chased his dream, and he literally slept under the boardwalk for a couple of years on and off and surfed and went to bars at night and to play music. And he was really a blue-collar guy, man, just trying to make it in the world.
So now if you look at the working-class struggles, you know, I'm sure there's some parallels to what Bruce did with his music in the 80s, but you hear a lot of conversation that, you know, right now in this election— Trump keyed in on the working class that's really been hollowed out in some communities, smaller to mid-sized communities, and that eventually Democrats have to respond to that in some way that's authentic. That even union towns in Ohio, for example, were going to Donald Trump in ways that, you know, union workers said, I've never seen anything like this. Do you think the working class right now, I mean, is Congress listening to them? Do you think this administration is? Forget party. Do you think they're being heard?
I do. I do think you're right, though. I think that his shocking upset had to do with the Rust Belt. Let's face it, you know, and the Midwest. And he took traditionally Democratic states, traditionally heavy union states, and he won them because he was tapping into those the blue collar person who felt really kind of like, and you talk about Bruce Springsteen, you talk about they were being underrepresented. You know, the Democratic Party does a very good job of identifying the disaffected, you know, and bending over backwards with funding and, you know, on the liberal side. But they seem to forget that blue-collar guy who's got a wife and a kid and making $50,000 a year and trying to make ends meet is getting hammered by a lot of the Democratic programs for, you know, higher taxes, higher health care costs. And they feel like they're being left behind. And they feel like they're killing themselves. And no one's really paying attention to them. And I think Trump tapped into that, and I think everyone's paying attention to Washington. And now there is this great struggle to see who's going to get the attention long term, which is quite interesting.
Well, and I'm always curious to hear from, especially members of Congress, is if you agree with this idea that to some degree with globalization, some jobs won't come back. You know, Trump spent the campaign painting a picture that doesn't have to be true, that we don't have to accept that. Then, and it's not just, you know, well, Kodak's not going to have 65,000 people working. I think Rochester has gotten its head around that. But in generally speaking, are we not being realistic, or can we change? Can we reprioritize our values in Washington? And can some of those jobs come back?
Oh, there's just no question in my mind. Because he tapped into something that a lot of people feel, not just the disaffected blue-collar guy, but a lot of us, but especially disaffected blue-collar guy. These trade deals we got into, quite frankly, to use the term, they suck. They have been unbalanced. Dairy farmers in Wayne County and dairy farmers in Cayuga County can't even sell their product in Canada because Canada's got protectionist milk practices. And meanwhile, Canada and U.S. are part of NAFTA. It sounds kind of crazy. But then you look at the rest of the world's tax structure compared to ours, and the manufacturing taxes that we pay in this country are double to triple what most of the rest of the world pays. And what Trump is basically trying to say, and what a lot of us have been trying to say, and one of the reasons I got into politics after being a career prosecutor, I'm saying, just level the playing field and let's see what happens. There's no question his job's left for two reasons. One is labor costs, and two is the cost of doing business in the U.S., in particular taxes and regulation. We can fix the taxes and regulation here. And we've already done and rolling back a lot of the onerous regulations. But the taxes have got to be fixed going forward. And I can talk about that in a minute. Overseas, where you used to pay someone 10 cents an hour in Mexico or 20 cents an hour in China, you're now paying them a lot more. So the labor costs are coming up. So that great disparity is not what it once was. And we in the United States, I think, have really gone through such a shakeout over the last two decades, losing all the jobs like Kodak and Xerox here and GM and Syracuse and General Electric and all those, we're leaner and meaner manufacturers here. We're automated. We're high-tech. You can't just come out of high school and go right to work at a factory. You need some technical training, which we need to work on more. But I think that we are poised to really do well and bring a lot of jobs back home if we can level the playing field on the regulatory and on the tax side. And I really think it's going to happen.
Is that protectionist?
I don't think it's protectionist. It's protectionist if we were doing things unilaterally that other countries weren't. We're one of the only countries in the world that doesn't have some sort of a VAT tax on goods in our country. And we're one of the only countries in the world that, we have one of the highest tax rates in the world for manufacturers. So to me, it's protectionist if you're not if you're doing more than level the playing field, but it's not protectionist. For example, what Canada's doing with their milk prices, that's protectionism. Right, and it's screwing our dairy farmers here, because if the playing field was level, I think our dairy farmers would really kill them because we're more efficient. But that's protectionism. But I'm talking just leveling the playing field. I don't see it as protectionism.
Now, I think your colleagues on the political left would say that they may not disagree with this idea that trade deals, to use a phrase of art, suck a little bit or are imbalanced and unfair. I'm using a congressional phrase
it's a congressional phrase I've coined. It sucks.
Okay. And so even if your colleagues on the left would agree with that, they might say, but look, what Congressman Katko is saying is the opposite of what they would do. Instead of saying, well, look, the standards are different there, we're getting killed, we need to take some of the regulations off, your colleagues on the left would say those regulations protect workers, protect people, and instead what we need to be doing is pressuring other countries to raise their standards and not allow people to be paid such terrible wages, to have no standards, to have no protections for workers, and that you've got it backwards. What would you tell them?
I would say good luck with that. What incentive would China have? What incentive would Russia have, India or Brazil or any of those, BRIC, the four big ones I always mention? What incentive are they having to do the things that we've unilaterally disarmed with? And I'm not talking about protecting workers' rights. We should always protect workers' rights. And the regulations having to do with that, absolutely. Regulations having to do with keeping our environment clean and all that, absolutely. But there's a lot of onerous, tedious regulations that cost our companies and our people a lot more here that they don't have to deal with overseas. It's just a lot of bureaucratic BS, basically. And I'm not talking about the core things you need to protect workers and keep them safe. But you're never going to get other countries to just say, oh, yeah, we'll unilaterally impose these restrictions on our employees just because they do it in the U.S. And, yeah, if the U.S. comes in, yeah, okay, well, listen, we'll do that. That's not going to happen. It's called competition. So unless you level the playing field, it's not going to happen.
Okay. When it comes to examples of that, you mentioned what farmers in Wayne County are dealing with. What are some examples of regulations that are not aimed at protecting workers or the environment that look onerous to you?
We have rolled back so many in the last several months. A lot of them were done in the last 100 days of the Obama administration. A lot of them have to do with the amount of paperwork just to deal with a temporary worker in this country. I'll give you an example. There's a farm in Syracuse, outside of Syracuse. They had four workers come in that they needed to help bring in their crops from Mexico. They have to do all kinds of they pay $2,500 to $3,000 per employee just to get them to come over. That's what they had to pay the government for it. And then they had to pay their travel expenses on top of that. So they were done with those four workers, and their crops were over. They were going to send them back home. another farmer needed them for to bring in their crop, and then they're going to go back home, right? And the four temporary workers wanted to stay. They wanted to do it. It was 82 pages of paperwork for a farmer trying to run a farm just to transfer those guys to work for 4 weeks so another farmer could use them and use more labor and then send them back home. That's the kind of stuff I'm talking about that our farmers deal with every day and manufacturers deal with every day. And that's the kind of things that we need to streamline.
Now, you're a competition guy, right? Competition's a good thing?
Absolutely.
We have seen in this country economic concentration. We see more mergers. We see fewer big companies controlling a lot of economic
power.
Look
at the airlines, for example.
Exactly right. So a lot of concentration of economic power in fewer and fewer hands. And you've got some people now arguing for more of the Brandeis, the antitrust, the anti-monopoly stuff that might look like the federal government throwing its weight around, but they say it's about real competition.
Oh, yeah. Those laws have been on the books forever.
But they're not enforced.
I started out as an antitrust lawyer, believe it or not, Washington, D.C., doing major antitrust litigation. And it's highly complicated, but it's a basic premise. That is, if you have too much of a market share and you're going to merge with someone else who has too much of a market share and you're going to be able to basically control the market, that's not a good thing. So I totally agree that there should be robust enforcement of the antitrust laws. There's no question about it.
But what would it take for that to actually happen right now?
Well, I think it's happened, like, for example, the beer industry, which I'm very familiar with because my client was Anheuser-Busch. InBev came in, right, mm-hmm. and bought Anheuser-Busch, yep. That was an earth-shattering move for the beer industry. They had to spin off a lot of their lines and force them out to other places. And then I think some of the lines were some of the Mexican beers, if I'm not mistaken, Dos Equis and some of the others. A group like Constellation here in Rochester mm-hmm. got part of that, right? And all of a sudden Constellation's growing now, which is in the beer lines. And there's another merger with Molson Coors and another one. And so they're constantly forcing them to spin off things that they believe to be anti-competitive. But like the beer market, right? You saw InBev's this big monster. They're getting killed by the independents. The independents are killing them, which is great, man. You see all these organic brewers in
New
York State.
The craft brewers, yeah.
The craft brewers. And so that's a constant source of threat. So their market share is never going to get that big because of that. But regardless, they did some pretty good surgical restructuring of the markets on that type of a merger that really worked.
The Comcasts of the world, those kind of mergers, should they be allowed?
Not if they take away too much market share, no. No, I mean, if there's no competition, that's a real concern to me, to be honest with you. And I was on the other end. I was defending Anheuser-Busch and a lot of pretty aggressive antitrust cases back then. But then when you do acquisitions, that was a constant thing to try and justify the acquisitions, not making sure you get too much of the market share. So yeah, it's always a question of is there enough competition to generate and keep the pressure for competition and keep the pressure on prices low? That's a key.
Talking to Congressman John Katko, representing the 24th Congressional District of New York State. And we've got a lot to talk about when it comes to the Affordable Care Act and what's next year. I saw an interview you did back in February, and you said that, you know, major carriers are calling it a death spiral already, and that Congress has to do something. That was in February. You said Republicans are doing the hard thing at the time. You said you could have started with tax reform or something, maybe a little lower hanging fruit, tried to tackle something a little more complex and difficult. I'm not sure if you felt like it went all that well, but what's your assessment now? I mean, AHCA, and what do you expect next year?
Well, I think it is an incredibly complex thing. It's about one-fifth or more of our economy, the healthcare. 20% of an American economy is a pretty darn big chunk of any economy. It's larger than that itself is larger than most economies in the world. So it is a very complex thing, right? And we got to start with the fundamental premise that in its current form, it's not going to be sustainable long term. We've had major insurance companies tell us time and again that, including Aetna, said that, quote, it's in a death spiral, end quote. You know, and it's by 2018. I'm curious to see when the rates come out soon for 2018. They're coming out in May, I believe. I think they're going to indicate another huge increase in rates, and that's what's killing the guy you mentioned before, the guy making $50,000 a year and has a couple of kids and a wife and is trying to make ends meet, and his insurance is going up again. And you know, deductibles are going up again, and people are wondering what the heck is going on here. Now, it's not a sustainable model going forward, and we have to fix it. The problem is, I think we went at it wrong. We went at it very quickly. We didn't have a lot of input in it. There was no amendments even at all in the process, the whole process to get the bill to the floor. And then before the bill got to the floor, everyone's like, hey, wait a minute here, you know. I think it needs a lot more work needs to be done on it. I think I applaud the leadership for trying to tackle it. But I think that they need to take a much broader view. One of the concerns I have for New York State is that in its current iteration, the current plan they have, I think it's a bad deal for New York. And I think it's, they took states like New York who have Medicaid expansion, which was a very big part of how they got everybody insurance in New York State. And they basically seem to be punishing the Medicaid expansion states. And, what would happen in effect if this law was passed as currently set up by the Republicans would be probably about a $7 billion in cuts to New York State health care through Medicaid. That's crushing, and that's way too much, and that's not right. And so they've got to find a better way to find a solution. It's very complicated, and I don't pretend to have all the answers, but I do tell you what, I'm going to look out for my constituents, and I just think it's a bad deal for them. That's why I opposed it.
You said back in February, I think people will give you credit for being willing to be critical of your own party. You said that, quote, we've been vehemently opposed to the ACA since 2009, but we've moved glacially on a replacement. In other words, you have had 7 years.
Yeah.
What's been going on? Does that mean do you think your party has not really been all that serious about this other than just opposing so-called Obamacare?
I tell you, it's very easy to be in the opposition, right? And so when I ran in 2014 for the first time, I basically, I was wondering, it's been 5 years now since it's been on the books. What's your alternative? What's your plan? And I said, I'm never going to vote for a repeal unless a replacement's ready. And I stand by that. And it kind of is confounding to me that after all these years, they don't have, and all these analysis and of the product, that they haven't come up with a better solution yet. And then when they come up with a better solution, they rush it through real quick so before people can really digest the impact of it. And it's just not been a good process. And so, yeah, it's always easy to be the opposition party, man. But when the dog catches a car and you actually have to figure out what you're going to do, right? Yeah, you better have a plan.
But that's an indictment of Paul Ryan and the leadership, isn't it?
It's not an indictment of that because I think that, they were trying to do the right thing. I give them credit for trying to tackle something that's a political nightmare for them. I give them credit for at least giving it a shot, for sure. But I don't think the process was as well thought out as it could be.
All right, so what should we expect next with healthcare then?
I think they're going to try and bat something around again. They're well aware of people's concerns now, I think they figured that out. We've got the far right wing of our party is very dug in, and I think they just want to see repeal, not much of a replacement, really. And that's not doesn't make sense to me. So, it's going to be a struggle, I think. I think they'll give it a shot, and I have no idea what the end result's going to be.
Let's get our only break of the hour and come right back with Congressman John Katko. I'm Evan Dawson, Tuesday on The Next Connections. Just back from the March for Science, and there were marches in Washington, a huge one in Chicago, Rochester, even Antarctica. There were marches around the world for science this past weekend, and we'll talk to scientists about how they view the state of their profession. Then in our second hour, understanding the state of the foster care system in this country. That's all Tuesday on Connections. I'd like to talk a little bit about security and foreign policy, and I'll start with something right off the news recently. I think strangely, and I don't think that's editorializing, I thought it was strange to see our president offering congratulations to Erdogan in Turkey for essentially consolidating even more power, that this is a figure that has been imprisoning journalists and has been certainly willing to consolidate the kind of power that looks a lot like a dictatorship, and our president is congratulating him. Were you uncomfortable with that at all?
I didn't see him congratulate him. I didn't know that, but I'm familiar with Erdogan. I've been to Turkey.
Yeah.
I did a congressional delegation to the Middle East, and Erdogan didn't even want to see us. He has his hands full with a highly volatile country right now. You have Muslim fundamentalists on one side. You have the Kurds, who they hate. So they're part of this three-pronged craziness going on in Syria. So he has a lot of issues trying to keep control of his own country. And he felt that he needed this power, this consolidation of power to put down. Remember, there was a recent coup attempt against him.
Sure.
So they are trying to, he's trying to maintain control, but I don't think it's ever good to give any leader of a quote-unquote democratic government these extraordinary powers. I think it's a dangerous thing, and it's down the road towards dictatorship, and that's not a good idea.
Are we close to seeing more boots on the ground regarding ISIS, and should we have more boots on the ground?
I don't think we're close to seeing boots on the ground against ISIS. I haven't heard any generals advocate for a massive military incursion into ISIS. I think what I have heard, and what you're starting to maybe see a little bit, is that we're taking the gloves off a bit more with respect to our tactical abilities, the tactical weapons and what have you. And that's a good thing. And, you know, when I was over in Iraq and I sat down and talked to the generals over there in Baghdad, that was a hairy ride in, by the way, in helicopter and hairy ride out. That was flak jackets and helmets. And I was in Congress about 5 months at the time. And looking down, you could see the plumes of smoke from where ISIS was bombing the outskirts of Iraq there, the city. And it was clear to me that their military had to have the will to protect themselves. And unless they have the will to protect themselves, there's no amount of American people that are going to change that. And so our last year or so, year and a half, they've been changing that dynamic. And the Iraqi soldiers are getting better trained. And for us to go over there and train them, that's one thing. Taking up arms for them, I think we've seen that already. And that's not our fight. What was really struck me was when ISIS first came into fruition and took over a couple of the cities in Iraq, you saw Iraqi soldiers that were, six or seven to one of the ISIS soldiers as far as numbers running away. I'm like, why would we shed blood for them if they don't want to stand up for themselves? But now they're standing up for themselves. If we can give them air support and give them training, that's one thing. Boots on the ground, I don't see it, not short term at least.
If you read what Jeffrey Goldberg wrote in The Atlantic about the Obama doctrine on foreign policy, you know, this president has admitted that he felt like he made mistakes on Syria. There's been a lot of talk about the red line of 2013, that he drew that red line and then did not follow through on the threat.
Huge mistake.
But he did say later that one of the reasons was, if you look at the history of our country getting involved in Middle Eastern conflict, it is a terrible record in a very complex, difficult place to ever quote-unquote win. And so even though he drew the red line, he felt like, are we going to put ourselves in the middle of another conflict? Right now, I know you feel like Russia's a bad actor and they have, you know, kind of come to Assad's aid. What are the good options here? What is the best case scenario that you can see?
What Trump did. Okay. They used chemical weapons again after Obama got into a BS agreement with Russia and Syria that they bought chemical weapons. And, you know, 4 years later, lo and behold,
they
magically they're there.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
If you didn't notice this, one thing, a lot of members of Obama's administration applauded Trump's move. No one was saying back in 2014, and no one's saying today, that we need to invade Syria. But giving him a brushback pitch by bombing the bombings that Trump did that one night, we didn't try and kill anybody. We just said we basically gave notice of the base, clear out, because we're going to bomb the crap out of it. That was the first time that they've seen an American president in close to 8 years have the stones to back up what he had to say. And you're dealing with these leaders in the Middle East that are bad actors, and dealing with Russia as a bad actor is just like dealing with kids and just like dealing with gangbangers. And the only thing they really understand is strength, especially gangbangers, and they're prosecuting for 20 years. If they sense that you're not, you don't have the evidence, or they sense that you don't have the guts to go to trial, they'll walk all over you. And they sensed Obama didn't have the will to back up his words, and they walked all over him. And for the first time in 40 years, Russia was involved in Syria, and Russia invaded the Ukraine and took over part of that and was belligerent, have been belligerent ever since.
We're not going to go to war with Russia
What I'm saying is they didn't respect him enough with him backing up his words. So when Obama talked tough, nobody listened because he didn't back up his words, especially with the red line. So Trump is taking more of a tactical, I think, of kind of like what Reagan did and what Clinton did before him, too, Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton talked tough, and when he had to, he backed it up. And Reagan did the same thing. And I think that's the only thing that these despots in the Middle East understand. If they have a modicum of fear about you, they will maybe take a little bit more measured response.
But, Mr. Congressman, I think if the president, President Obama, were sitting here, he might say, Syria, mistakes were made. But we dropped 26,000 bombs in the last year alone of his presidency. You look at Libya, they talked tough, then they did something, and now you look back and you might say, maybe we shouldn't have. It's not always an easy situation to decide what's tough. And now you look at what Trump has done, and I understand you say, okay, chemical weapons, the side used them, there's a response. But you can't, if he keeps dropping bombs surgically this way, it's not going to overthrow Assad. It's not going to be a regime change. It's not going to fundamentally change. It would take something bigger to fundamentally change things there, wouldn't it?
Of course it would. But the bottom line is you got to send them. It's a message. It was absolutely a message. And I'd much rather be like Bill Clinton on foreign policy and in, Ronald Reagan on foreign policy than I would Neville Chamberlain or I would Barack Obama, because I think Barack Obama has a lot of the traits of Neville Chamberlain. If you remember in World War II, he tried to make a deal with Hitler. And how did that work out for him? And you look at what we did at Iran. We gave away the store, you know, and, you know, Iran is now being belligerent with us, and they violated that the terms of that agreement left and right, and we've done nothing about it. So the bottom line is, speak softly and carry a big stick. I really believe that's about the only way to deal with these guys.
Okay. And when it comes to the travel ban, you've been critical. You said the Trump administration, the rollout was, quote, extraordinarily poor, and that you said you hoped that President Trump would learn from it. That was back in February, that you can't just base a ban on religion or race. If you were designing an immigration or travel ban at all, would there be one, and what would it look like?
Mine would be based strictly on proper vetting procedures and not cutting the corners no matter what. I've talked to all kinds of refugee groups throughout my district and in D.C., and they've all said the same thing. We have no problem with doing the vetting. And I said, well, for a lot of these Syrians, that would mean they wouldn't get in because we couldn't verify them. We couldn't vet them because territories from which they came no longer exist. They're part of ISIS. So what do we do then?
So they can't come?
So they said, we understand. So try and find a way to ensure that proper vetting procedures that work, that keep our country safe and keep our citizens safe, is paramount. If you can do that, I have no problem with people coming into this country. We're in a country of immigrants. But vetting is critically important. What I found out, I work on Homeland Security, and what I found out was that the Obama administration was cutting corners when they couldn't verify information. And that's how this whole thing started. And the countries that he picked out, by the way, Trump picked out in his executive order, didn't come out of the air. That was what the intelligence agencies had told him. So he didn't just pick those out of the air. But nevertheless, if you ask me what my policy would be based strictly on how can we properly vet them or do a thorough vetting that works. And we got to be mindful of that. Don't forget, there's people that have been coming to the United States through the refugee process that have tried to do a serious harm. There's a guy who came from Iraq in early 2009 or 11, I think it was. And he settled in Bowling Green, Kentucky. And lo and behold, they found all kinds of roadside bombs that killed our soldiers with his fingerprints on them. So they start investigating him, another refugee from Iraq, and they find out that they're in a major plot to do harm in the United States and also to send arms back to ISIS. So they've since pled guilty and they're in jail. But so it's not a perfect process, even under the best of circumstances. But when ISIS and al-Qaeda both say, we're going to infiltrate the West through the refugee process, and they were successful, tragically, in doing so in Paris and in Brussels, we got to be mindful of that, and we got to make sure that the safety of our citizens is paramount.
Has there been a single successful attack on the soil from someone who used the refugee process to get in?
Oh, there's been several that, like I just mentioned one in Bowling Green, is an example of
not on the soil instances. Here, right?
Well, they tried to. We stopped it. So that shouldn't give you any comfort. Listen, I'm not saying no, and again, I'm not saying we should have a ban. I'm saying we should just make sure properly vet everybody comes in.
Okay, and does that mean there are going to be parts of Syria, for example, where right now people are just not eligible to come here because, as you said, those territories don't technically exist anymore?
Well, I think it's just basically we can't sit there and say, well, I feel sorry for this person. They got to come, even if we don't know who they are. As long as whatever vetting procedures are set up are followed, I'm okay with it. And that would be the devil, is to try and figure out ones that are proper that you can vet. And I mean, don't forget, San Bernardino, we didn't properly vet that woman before she came in. She wasn't a refugee, but she came in here from another country, and she had anti-U.S. sentiments before she came in, and then she involved in killing 14
people.
How
would you have found that, though?
There's ways you could. I'm not sure, but for example, mining the open sources of the internet, you would have seen her postings. You know, there's algorithms out there that can do that. Things like that, you know, that are more modern technology based, you know.
Okay. And when it comes to our dealings with Russia, you know, you said a couple months ago that it was important to look more closely at the allegations surrounding the Trump team in Russia, that, you know, you were open to the idea of sort of a special investigator outside of Congress. But right now, you know, you took it seriously. You wanted to learn more. Here we are in April. What have you learned, and how do you feel about what you've been learning?
Well, I haven't learned a ton because the investigations aren't done. But I know the House and the Senate Foreign Intelligence Committees are really going at it in a bipartisan manner. Now, Nunes was made a major mistake, and he's now off the investigation for that purposes. But I know the Democratic lead in the House, and he's a very squared away guy. He's a former federal prosecutor. And I know that the Senate, they're working in a very bipartisan manner. So I think we got to let them do their work. And whatever that work leads us, it's kind of like when I was doing cases, I never make presumptions before the facts come out. And I think it's important that the facts lead us where they're going to be. And the facts have not been fully vetted yet. But they're diligently working on it. If there's something there, you can bet your bottom dollar that it's going to come out because they're working at it. And no one's going to turn a blind eye to that.
Okay. Are you comfortable overseas with people like Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump representing us?
Well, what do you mean by representing us?
Well, I mean, certainly Jared Kushner, when he gets to go and, you know, in Iraq, he is wearing a sort of a silly-looking suit with a flak jacket and meeting with, you know, people in military command. It has a patina of representation for us, whether it's fair.
Yeah,
or not.
Yeah, but I mean, he's not making deals. I mean, is he going over there to learn things to come back to talk to him about? Sure. Is he making policy?
I guess I'm asking if his family is too involved in the actual workings of our government. Would you draw lines?
You know, I'm not sure. He is not an idiot. He's a very bright guy. So from a qualification standpoint, were it not for the family connection, people wouldn't be scratching their head as much, I don't think. But everybody, when they come into the White House, have different people that they use as advisors. Some are better than others.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about that. But I think it's too early to tell because I don't think he's in a position of influencing him and talking to him. You hear anecdotal stories, but you don't really know for sure. And he's certainly not representing the United States in an official capacity like Rex Tillerson and Secretary of State or the Secretary of Defense. So is he going over to see what's over there and see how he can help and be a special advisor? Sure. Did Obama have special advisors? Absolutely. Did everybody that's been a modern-day president have special advisors? Of course. I think it's too early to tell.
Okay. Are you at all concerned that his family is in position to profit overseas? You know, Trump Towers, Turkey, Trump Towers and Trump properties in different places. Are you worried about that at all?
Oh, sure. I mean, I think that I don't want to say tangled web, but I do want to say that the job is difficult enough without having to have all those landmines to try and navigate to make sure that there's no hint of impropriety. So sure, that's a concern. How much of a concern, I don't know. Just because a man has been very successful in the business world, I don't think you should disqualify him from the presidency, but you should make sure you distance yourself as best you can from that stuff while you're in office to erase any hint of propriety.
Got a few minutes left with Congressman John Katko, and he's in studio with us. He worked in law enforcement, closely with law enforcement for a long time, and I'm curious to know how you feel about the climate in general right now, police-community relations around the country. You know, is this a healthy moment that we're talking about a lot of tough subjects, or do you think police are getting an unfairly bad rap at times? How do you feel about this, Joe?
Both.
Okay.
Okay. I worked hand in glove with police officers on the front lines for 20 years, going after gangs and going after the most violent people in El Paso, Puerto Rico, and here. I saw everything you could possibly see, and I've seen officers getting shot. I've seen them, you know, going to worse situations, and I can tell you 99.9% of those officers always do a great job, okay? But you don't hear about those in the news. You don't hear about the great stories about an officer bravely going in and taking out a really bad guy and arresting him and getting him off the streets, and that guy's killed a bunch of people, or finding that key piece of evidence which makes sure that a community is safe from these animals that have killed people and maimed their neighborhoods. You don't hear about any of that. But you do hear about the bad actors, and you do hear about them because of modern technology and the camera phone and all that stuff. And the cops that are bad, they should be brought to justice. And I prosecuted 5 bad cops in Schenectady, New York, a major, major police corruption case that had far-reaching implications. But I can also tell you that they are by far and away the extreme. They are not the norm. And I sense lately, and I think when the cops were killed, I believe it was in Dallas, they're basically just assassinated. I think people, had this healthy questioning of cops that morphed into a hatred and all cops are bad, and that's not true at all. But hold the cops accountable, the ones that need to be held accountable, but let's do a little bit better job of praising police officers who risk their lives every day for us, because they certainly don't get the credit they deserve.
One of the premises you hear, and I wonder if you reject or accept this premise, is that people of color in this country are treated differently by law enforcement. Do you believe that that's true?
In pockets, I'm sure it is. Again, by and large, I think the vast majority of police officers are colorblind and do their job like the way they're supposed to. And again, you hear about the bad ones as well. You should. But again, it would be nice to hear about the good ones. I know a lot of cops who go into tough areas and do all kinds of great things and for those neighborhoods and spend their free time helping kids and, you know, working at soup kitchens and all that stuff, just trying to help the neighborhood. You never hear about them. But when there's race relation issues, you're going to hear about them, and justifiably so. But again, I would love to hear about the feature stories about police officers and firemen that are doing good.
When it comes to sentencing reform, we've even heard Paul Ryan in recent years say that sentencing reform is something that we might see some bipartisan agreement on. Do we need sentencing reform of any kind?
Yeah. I mean, I think we've had it to a large extent.
Okay.
I mean, there has been, I'm counting now, at least four major revisions of the sentencing guidelines in the last decade, the federal sentencing guidelines, along the drug, especially along the drug spectrum in particular, and mandatory minimums as well. And yeah, there's definitely reform that's needed and needs to be institutionalized. I think that lower level criminals, I mean lower level, not major, lower level on
sure.
the federal level,
yeah.
That are involved in crimes that are felonies and deservedly so, but also were fueled by drug addictions or some kind of heavy drug use. Maybe and they're their first time offender. Maybe those people ought to have a take a look at taking a different route than just doing a normal prosecution. Not saying don't prosecute them, but perhaps give them an opportunity to get their life together. With the carrot being, if you don't get your life together, you're going to jail.
Do we have too many people incarcerated in this country?
I don't look at it that way. I just look at the fairness or unfairness of laws. Because when you start saying we have too many people in this country incarcerated, you inevitably overreach to fix it. And when you fix it, you let bad people out that shouldn't be out. And a lot of my gang guys that I prosecuted, a guy, for example, got caught with a gun in his hand, 14 shootings that gun was involved in. And he had his sentence reduced three times because of the laws and concerns about federal overcrowding. And he's back on the street now, and that's not a good thing. That guy is not a good thing to be on the street right now, and he should have been serving his full sentence. Now, is there other ones, like a very low-level person in a drug organization who was caught with a lot of drugs but had a major drug problem and otherwise was an okay person but just kind of fell off because of drug abuse? Should that guy be treated differently? Maybe. But, you know, when you talk about guns and shootings and stuff, that's a different story.
Pew has it at 60%. Gallup has it as 57% of Americans would like to see full legalization of marijuana. Would you ever support that?
No, and it's only because not because I'm a prude, because I probably prosecuted well over 1,000, probably 1,500 people in my 20 years as a federal prosecutor, and every one of them, you get a big sentencing report that chronicles the entire life of the person. It's usually anywhere from 40 to 80 pages long. And in those reports are everything about the person, from their criminal history to their family history to their drug abuse and everything else. And everyone says, no, marijuana is not a gateway drug. But I can tell you, of the vast majority, 80 to 90%, I would say, of the individuals who had a drug problem, they all started with marijuana. And I cannot get over that for my own purposes. Medicinal use, absolutely. Absolutely. And if there's things for people that are medically related or for psychological related, absolutely. But in a controlled environment. But for that reason, I could never say it would be a good thing.
80 to 90% started with marijuana. I bet you 100% had peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. Is correlation causation here?
No, because if you look at the biggest offender of health issues in this country and the biggest offender of absenteeism at work and poor performance and broken marriages and everything else, it's alcohol. And alcohol was once illegal. They made it legal again, and it's by far the number one health risk in this country. And so I see marijuana is in a similar vein, I guess.
Okay, and heroin is getting out of control.
Yes.
Anything that, from your work as a prosecutor, from your work in the system, do you look at any possible fix to, other than, you know, there's a number of people who chronicle the working class saying one of the fixes is a better economy, more jobs, more fewer people losing hope. I don't know if you agree with that, but what can be done?
It's a mixture of all those things. But one thing I can tell you is, it is the one drug that I've seen in my 20 years. I've seen every possible drug known to man that's gained influence, like methamphetamine and all those. This is the only one that has routinely fatal consequences. It is by far the most lethal drug that I've ever seen on the streets. I did a heroin forum up in Oswego 2 weeks ago, and the night before the forum, seven people in Buffalo alone died of heroin overdoses. And the problem is not just the heroin. They're lacing it with these synthetic drugs. So we need to do a better job. It's a three-pronged stool. It's enforcement, it's treatment, it's prevention. Okay, we've got to do a better job of trying to stop the flow of these drugs coming across the border. And we got to do a better job of with the related, you know, infusion into this country of synthetic drugs, especially from China. And then we've got to do better with prevention and, you know, keeping, you know, public awareness, preventing people, trying to stop people from getting involved in to begin with. And then, of course, there's, you know, treatment. And there's nowhere near enough treatment for these people. I mean, the Krauss Chemical Dependency in Syracuse has 500 to 600 patients at any one time. And they have a waiting list of up to 500 people at any one time. And a lot of those people don't make it to the time that they get their treatment before they pass on. So we need to do better on all three.
Got to ask you about the legislation that you introduced in the House that would advance the designation of Fort Ontario and the Safe Haven Holocaust Refugee Shelter Museum in Oswego to national park status. First of all, for people who have never been there, don't know what this is. What is it?
It's a very, very cool place. It's the only fort in the United States history that has been involved in every war since the French and Indian War, up through World War II and even Vietnam War. And it's an unbelievable place. It's right next to the port of Oswego, just to the right of it as you're looking out at Lake Ontario. It's right in downtown Oswego. And during World War II, it had the really unbelievable distinction of being the only place in the United States where they housed Holocaust refugees from Europe fleeing the Holocaust. And when you really read into it, there is tens of thousands of people that may have survived if we had different immigration policies back then, and they didn't, because we wouldn't take them. We wouldn't take any more refugees from these war-torn areas. And somehow, some way, Roosevelt and I think Eleanor Roosevelt in particular helped get convince the president to let these people stay in Oswego. So they were housed at the fort. They weren't allowed to leave. They were fenced in. But they survived. Some people had children there, and they were largely assimilated into the U.S. society after that. And it's a great. We're going to try and make a national park. It's on a path. It's going to take a while.
What would that do for it, by the way, if it becomes a national park?
Well, because I think what it's going to do is, first of all, from a tourism standpoint, it's phenomenal for upstate New York. That and the Harriet Tubman National Park, we just made that a national park this year. There's a rich tourism in history in our upstate New York area that's underutilized. But I think from a learning perspective, too, from a refugee interpretive center and all those things, I mean, it'd be a really good thing. I mean, shows a benevolence of our country to some extent. It shows a history of a great fort, a rich history of a great fort. And I think it's going to would spawn a lot of good international discussion on the history of refugees and what we can learn from those mistakes moving forward.
Worth making the trip over there, huh?
Oh, God, yes. Even now, it's unbelievable. It's a really beautiful place.
Who's your favorite Democrat in Washington right now?
That's a good question. I respect an awful lot of them. Kathleen Rice is a good friend of mine. She was on the she co-chaired the committee with me. Kyrsten Sinema is sponsor of my paid family leave bill. That's a Republican alternative that I think it's pretty progressive. And so I respect her, and she runs our Wednesday morning spinning classes at 6 a.m., and she's brutal. She kicks the crap out of us. There's a lot of good eggs in that side of the aisle. I mean, the problem is that there's too much vitriol on both sides, and if you try and take a more independent view and a more inclusive view like I do, I think you can, you know, you do better. The old saying, get more flies with honey, you know? And I've had 18 bills pass the House in less than two terms. And every single one of those bills, the very first person is a Democrat, very first co-sponsor. And I intend to continue in that practice, right? And not everybody I introduce, and it's working. I've had 8 bills signed into law, so I want to try and lead by example, and being bipartisan is a good way to do that.
All right, last question. I know since January of 2015, you've had more than 72,000 citizen requests, phone calls, emails, calls to the office.
90,000 about now.
90,000 now, wow. And I know you try to be as responsive as you can be. Going forward, what do you hope that you're going to accomplish this year that you're going to be able to tell your constituents? What is either you or your party in Congress, what can you get done this year?
Well, we're going to continue to do – I got major synthetic drug legislation I'm going to introduce that could be groundbreaking. I have the paid family leave bill, which I'm going to introduce. That's I think could be really groundbreaking, and it's starting to get some support.
In your own party?
Yeah, and I've got some local initiatives with respect to heroin and poverty and trying to bring jobs back to Central New York. I think tax reform, if it goes through, could have a profoundly major impact on the whole United States economy. Infrastructure is something we have to do, I think, in my mind, and I'm hopefully that's something we can get done, and hopefully we can tackle in a meaningful manner the Affordable Care Act crisis, and I believe it is in a crisis.
Congressman Katko, it's been our pleasure having you, and thank you so much for taking the time. Hope to do it again.
Yeah, sure, anytime, man. Thanks.
Our thanks to Congressman John Katko and his staff for being here. Thanks to our engineer, Rob Braden. The producer is Megan Mack. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon, and we're right back with you Tuesday on Member-Supported Public Radio.